Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Kathy McMahon. She's the peak oil shrink. I just listened to your interview with the podcaster KMO from SeaRealm.com. In that interview with KMO, Kathy, you triggered a bunch of thoughts I've been stewing about, like, what happens if we get an ugly, slow decline instead of a collapse? You called it a sucky collapse. What do you mean by that?
Well, a sucky kind of collapse is one that's just not dramatic. You know, food prices keep sneaking up, and they shrink the cans and keep the price the same, so you have a hard time noticing it. It's almost invisible unless you're actually impacted by it. I have a friend who is in the office technology business, and he and I were talking, and one of the things that he's seeing, because he's a salesperson, he goes around and talks to a lot of business people, is 2 years ago, he'd visit these same companies, and he'd speak to the person who was running the company, and he'd go back 2 years later to find that the same individual is now working for two separate companies half-time. And he said that he was recently approached, his company, office technology company, was recently approached by two large companies, corporations, and both of them wanted his company to sell their products because they don't have a sales force anymore, that's one of their ways of cutting back. And in my own experience, I was working for a mental health clinic and had been offered a full-time job, managing their training for psychology students. And what ended up happening is the same similar story, which is they hired one person to be the director, and they ended up giving her two jobs. That one of the jobs, which I was planning to get, and this job running the clinic, and handed me a few extra hours and said, run the program. So just heard from my daughter yesterday, in fact, who was told by the company, the nonprofit that she works for, that they're creating a new position. And it's not only her job, but it's another set of responsibilities in addition to that. And so this is what we're seeing in a sucky kind of collapse. We're seeing that we don't get any raise in pay, or maybe our benefits get cut, and so we actually are losing money. And suddenly, instead of doing one job, we now do two jobs. And if we're going to complain about it, then we risk losing those two jobs that we're only getting paid one salary for. It's like that. It's a process whereby everything is just more difficult, you know? Gas is just, you know, increasingly sneaking up there, more and more expensive. That vacation that we were planning on taking, there's just not the money to do it because the everyday expenses in life have really started to create debt for us. And to take on more debt when we're uncertain about our job, you know, is anxiety provoking for us. The anxiety increases. I see that a lot in my practice. The sense of despair and depression in not really being able to feel optimistic about the future and about your career, your education. Cutbacks are starting to happen, and you're aware of it. Like one of the universities just announced a whole series of cutbacks. And so all of these things, I think, play on our minds. They're not the zombie apocalypse where, you know, we're seeing tanks coming down the middle of our city streets, or we're seeing motorcycle gangs with leather jackets and machine guns. We're just seeing everyone around us gradually getting poorer, having less resources, being able to paint their house less often, not being able to update their automobile. And, you know, Dmitry Orlov says, you know, just looking shabbier. It's an emotional drain for the individual. It's an emotional drain on the family to really start to seriously question, are they going to have the cash to be able to send their child to college, or are they going to have the ability to send their child to summer camp when, you know, 5 years ago there wasn't really a question that that would be something that they would be able to do. So that's what I mean by it. And in some ways, I think, because it's a slow, stepwise deterioration, or what Nicole talks about is a lightning bolt deterioration, where it seems to get a little better. Like right now in the United States, the real estate market is improving. The prices for getting a mortgage are rock bottom. And so it looks like we're on the upswing. Everything looks kind of positive, but then it drops down. And each time it goes up, it never quite goes up quite as high as it was before. And when it drops down a little bit more. And our optimism begins to wane even on the upswing. You know, we're not quite as optimistic as we were the last time that they said we're out of the recession and things are turning around, because we don't see that actually happening in our everyday lives. Our everyday lives are still filled with the stresses that's involved with higher energy costs, fewer employment opportunities. And, you know, I was thinking about the logical progression of this energy technology company and, you know, understandably, the survival strategy of these companies that are attempting to cut their costs by using somebody else's salespeople. But what that ultimately means is that there will be fewer people employed. And as a result of having fewer people employed, there are fewer people to buy the product, which means that there's a general slowdown in production, which means, you know, so you can only go so far in draining the resources of a culture. You know, if people aren't working, they can't buy the product. If they don't buy the product, they cut back on the workforce. And that's, I think, what Nicole is talking about when she's talking about pushing on a string with deflation, is that you just can't get a foothold into stopping that gradual, sucky kind of deterioration of people's everyday lives.
Wow, you just expressed so much, and I've seen it too. Maybe a lot of us have to rethink who we are. We can't define ourselves in terms of our jobs.
Well, I think it's always been a kind of a risky proposition to define yourself in terms of what you do for a living. And I think, though, that it's part of the delusion that gets created when money becomes such a strong priority in a culture. You know, I'm thinking about just the extent to which employment has taken priority over family life for so many of us. And even people who are very invested in their family life themselves have found themselves in a situation where they don't even eat dinner anymore as a family. You know, if you don't eat dinner as a family, or maybe you can manage it once a week or something, but if other things take priority, whether it's the kids' sporting events or working late, or and it's moving from dinner to even breakfast, we're now having expectations from corporations that we have breakfast meetings. So we can't even, you know, share a bowl of cereal with our kids anymore. When that starts to happen, to answer the question, who am I, we then have to look at our employment circumstance, because that takes up such an enormous amount of our lives. And at least from what I can see, it's going to take even more of a chunk out of us. When now, instead of just doing one person's job to in order to cut back and to stay afloat, corporations are expecting us to do two people's jobs. And when we say there's not enough time in a day, their answer is, well, we'll find somebody who can create more time to devote to it. So I think that it's seductive to do that in the go-go times when you're ending up getting promotions, you're ending up getting more money, more praise from the people around you. But I think it's also, just in terms of physical limitation, it becomes overwhelming and a dominant part of your life when you end up working overtime without being paid for it and really worrying about your ability to perform in order to just keep your job.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Kathy McMahon. She's the Peak Oil Shrink, and we're talking about the possibility of a gradual decline, which she calls a sucky collapse. When I hear you talking, I'm reminded of the struggles that many of us have trying to convince other people, including people we love sometimes, that things are not going well, that we may have to readjust our expectations. There's denial about climate change. And I'm wondering whether all of that denial comes out of a deep, deep fear that we're just going to fall off some edge and be downright poor.
It depends upon how you define poverty, because I think that for a lot of us, especially in the United States, we've already been poor. We've already been suffering from a poverty of spirit, a poverty of beliefs in something other than material possessions, and a real paucity of involvement in community-type activities. I think we've been kind of sold a bill of goods, which says that we can live a virtual life in we can have a virtual community, and that that's the same as having a real life with real intimate people that we're involved with on a day-to-day basis, and a loving partner and emotionally connected children and a community that we really care about. I think that we lost a tremendous amount of community connection, or what I call, you know, being a patch of ground people, quote from Neil Young, one of Neil Young's songs. But, you know, a patch of ground people means that, you know, you've really invested in a particular area. You know, you really care what happens to the soil, what happens to the trees, what happens to the quality of the living space, not just for yourself and your own particular plot, but a recognition that your whole town is going to need to thrive in order for you to feel good and for your kids to be safe, for it to be a high quality of life. So if you've invested so much of your emotional energy in economics, and you really have allowed your attachment to the land around you to wane because you're moving and you're relocating every once in a while to a different area, if you've allowed your attachment, your passionate connection to your most intimate others to take a back seat to the demands for material goods, the demands for promoting yourself and your employment situation, and even a spiritual connection with any kind of religious or spiritual tradition or community involvement. If you've let all that lapse in favor of money, then yeah, you got a lot to be afraid of when you're looking at a downed economy and when you lose your job, when you lose your title, whatever that title is, because you then have to go home, you know, like a puppy that was caught in a rainstorm. You gotta come home into a house that does not have a lot of warmth to it anymore, that you haven't invested that everyday, day in and day out quality of life connection, which really turns a house into a home. So yeah, I think that there's a lot of reasons why people, you know, do become frightened and fearful of losing their job. And it's not just because of the shift in lifestyle that they're required to do, but, you know, without the 142 channels of television, you got to sit and look at somebody who you've been living with for 10 or 20 or 30 years and talk and share dreams when those dreams are still going to be alive to create some kind of a dream when money as a social lubricant has evaporated for you. But I think that the real concern is the poverty of spirit and the belief system that so many of us find ourselves in. You know, the opposite being, you know, we're not poor, we just don't have any money, which a friend of mine many, many years ago said. And that's a person who, you know, they have no money, so for entertainment, they're going down to the food pantry and they're giving out food, or they're cooking and serving people who have even less than they do. But for other people, not having money means that they're genuinely poor because there's nothing else going on in their life other than their ability to entertain themselves through cash.
Well, you know, there's a constant movement between the city and the country. I plan to leave the big city in 2014. I'm going to keep doing the radio show from a rural village where I can grow some vegetables and be more in touch with nature. That's partly insurance against what I see as the developing decline, whether it's slow or fast. But you know some people who are leaving that rural area and coming back to the city. Do you want to tell us about that?
Well, I was surprised in my interview with KMO that he's left the farm and decided in Tennessee and decided to move to New York City. So he lives in Brooklyn, I believe, at this point, and really has quite a cosmopolitan lifestyle that he's just grooving on, that he's digging. And I think for myself, one of the things that I came to the conclusion of after really thinking a lot, I mean, a lot of things came together with Nicole Foss's visit, but one of the things that really became clear to me is that we're living in an enormous house. We've got 9 acres. We're surrounded by all three sides, actually four sides, by woods. You can't see our house from the road. And, you know, we have the ability to farm. We have chickens. We had geese at one time. We have the ability to cut our own firewood and heat our in our stove. We have an enormous amount of food stored and all that kind of stuff. But what we realized was that despite all of that, as we're aging, one of the real advantages is to be able to be in a small city or a large town and be able to be, you know, walking distance from other people and activities and things like that. And so we are kind of bucking the trend in a lot of ways. We're going from a really rural environment into a much more, not certainly as large as New York City by any stretch of the imagination, but we're looking to be in a kind of walkable small city. And that's been an enormous shift for us in our thinking. And it really has shaken us up in terms of the way that we have traditionally thought and planned about what the future holds. We've prepared for a future that now we're just going to have to completely revamp what our goals are. And certainly I think there'll be many of our friends who won't at all be able to understand why we would make a choice like this. But for us, you know, in order to, we're entering into our 60s, and for us, the firewood could be all there ready, but if you're not capable and skilled in being able to cut it down and bring it in, that's a problem. And if you're 40 or 50 minutes away from any kind of a food store and you have a bad harvest one year, that puts you into a very difficult position when the price of gas continues to go up and up and up. So, and never mind just the morality issue of having two people living in a huge house and all of the fossil fuels that it takes to keep a house like this going. So we're hoping to really be able to dramatically downscale and live in a much, much smaller place, be able to be in a walkable location where our output of fossil fuels will be dramatically less. And really, I think both of us are kind of, with some fear and intrepidation, we're looking forward to investing into a community again and doing more work in being able to be part of a small city, part of the life of a large town. So that's our plan, and that's just hot off the presses right now.
That's big news, big news.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Well, we've talked a bit about seniors. I think we should talk about young people, and a lot of them have record massive student debt, and you can't discharge it with bankruptcy. It's a lifetime thing. Many young people won't get jobs they've been trained for, and I'm thinking about some countries, including European countries like Spain and Italy, where a lifetime of working is possible, where people just never do get a job. It could happen in England, America, or Canada. How will people adjust to that internally in their minds?
I think that you can look at it in a number of different ways. One of the ways that you can look at it is that we don't have debtor prison. And so it means that there's going to be a lot of people, young people, who will be in enormous amounts of debt that they just can't service, period. They just can't do it. They can't find work. And even if they do find work, they can't find work that's going to generate enough income for a lot of them to be able to pay off the student loans that are the equivalent of a mortgage payment for a lot of these kids. So I think that what you're going to see is you're going to see a lot of underground economy operating, and that doesn't get taxed to pay student loans. And I think that the biggest shift is going to be a psychological one, that they're going to have to accept the fact that they're living in a time where they are just going to have this state, which is a student loan, and whether it's floating over their heads and it makes for sleepless nights, or it's just a piece of paper that comes periodically that says you owe more money this month than you did last month, and that they're going to try and put it in its place, which is, that's one of the things I can't do anything about, you know? But I've written about this, and I'll tell you that of all of the stories that I've ever written about and gotten replies, email replies about, I have to tell you that the story that I wrote on the student loan debacle was really the most upsetting of all of them, because I think that one of the ways that you create despair in a culture is that you take your young people and, as I said in the piece, you put them in a barn, you lock the door, and then you burn the barn down. And I think that that's what, in the United States anyway, that's what we've done. And just recently, Obama's made some changes to try and lessen the onerous nature of student loans and made some changes in that front. But it did nothing for the people who graduated before he signed that legislation into law. So for so many folks, I think that they really will have to, and I've seen it with my own daughter, they really will have to invest in something other than being able to have, you know, typical commercial credit, credit cards, mortgage, car loans, and that kind of thing. They're really going to need to live in a very dramatically different way by force of circumstance. And how they will approach that is going to, I think, depend to a large extent on the extent to which they've accepted that they've been caught in a historical period that they had no control over. Just like if you were 20 at the point where the Great Depression hit, you can either look at it in terms of the worst thing that ever happened to you, or there's one story I particularly like where the guy said when the Depression hit, he'd set up a business, and the business crashed, and he lost everything. So he said that suddenly he felt free because he hated business, and he started to write songs because he loved to rhyme. And before you knew it, people liked to hear his rhyming and his songs and started buying sheet music. And he became quite popular as a songwriter, whereas had the Depression not hit, he would have continued in his business and have been led a quite miserable life from the way that he describes it. So I think to a large extent it's going to be the attitude that the young people have about whether they've accepted the fact that they're in a historical period, that, you know, they are living in dramatic times and that it's not their fault to find themselves in these dramatic circumstances and to be able to accept it as a piece of paper instead of the burden, the anxiety, the depression that can come with feeling like they're deeply in debt and they'll never get out of it.
Well, as you say, there's no debtor's prison, and in a way, they're better off than the pot-smoking generation of the late 60s. The United States is still arresting about 800,000 people a year for simple possession of marijuana. And so that was kind of a historical accident, in my opinion, because the legislators like to drink, and many of them drank plenty. You know, we all want to know how this is going to turn out, and I could see for North America especially a kind of fork in the road here, and it could go both ways, where to some degree, we see crazy violence. You know, we saw that school shooting, just nutty stuff. And at the same time, we hear about more communities developing and young people going into communities and trying out new things. Are we going to be able to tolerate those two streams at the same time, where things fall apart and things come together?
Yeah, I think that we're going to have to. And of course, we always have. There has always been some level of mental illness, and that's what we saw with that Sandy Hook shooting. There have always been situations, and of course, if it's not guns, it'll be like it is in China. It's machetes and cars that run children down. So I think that that's a given. But so much of what makes us human involves things that have very little to do with how much money we have in our pockets or violence around us. It has to do with our feelings of support by the people in our lives. And I think that even when you live in a violent neighborhood, humans are noted for their ability to adjust and to take certain things for granted and to be able to live their lives anyway, despite the rise in crime or that kind of thing. So I think, yeah, I think that isn't a very popular book starting out saying it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. Clearly, one of the things that happened during the Great Depression is that people got together, and when they did, they would have rent parties, and the band would play, and when people walked in, they threw what they could throw in a hat to help the people who were throwing the party to be able to pay the back rent so that they wouldn't be booted out on the street. And they partied all night, and they had fun. And so I think that we're gonna see that. And just like I think the key important thing for me is, just like when you have a monkey who sticks his paw into a jar and he wants that banana and he wants to pull that banana out, but he can't do it while he's holding on to the banana. If he lets the banana go, his hand can slide out no problem, and he wants his hand out, but he wants the banana too. And so I think that that's our biggest challenge, is that if we're going to be insisting like that monkey on holding on to that banana, holding on to wealthier times, insisting on, you know, living in bigger homes, and insisting on the lifestyle that we can no longer afford, we're going to remain miserable. But if we can understand that there are just some things that have changed for us in our lives, and to let go and to pull our hand out and to go on and do the next thing, I think that that will provide us an opportunity to be able to have a quality of life. Because as I'm fond of saying, look, we only have one lifespan. We are mammals. We're entitled to have a good, high-quality life for the time that we're here. And lamenting that it isn't the same life that we might have had 10 years or 20 years ago is just a tremendous waste of time, because we are here now, and we do have moment by moment by moment the ability to really appreciate whatever benefits that we're currently being offered. So, you know, again, so much of it is, in fact, psychological, despite the fact that we may not be living at the same level, that we may be facing enormous challenges, as we certainly are, not only in the economy, but also in the environment, in the energy sector, et cetera. But I think that our ability to remain optimistic about our own potential, optimistic about our own capacity to love passionately, to care passionately, to be invested passionately in a particular place, because this is the place, this is the time that we find ourselves in, is going to be very, very, very important.
Dr. Kathy McMahon, do you have upcoming speaking events or publications or a blog that you would like to tell us about?
I'm still working on my book, I Can't Believe You Think That, which is a book that talks about intimate arguments about some of the most important issues of our time, like peak oil, climate change, and economic shifts. So that's still something that's ongoing. And, of course, I'm going to be editing this four-hour talk that I had with Nicole Foss, and I'll be putting that on my website as well for people to be able to enjoy. In addition to making my chickens fatter so that we can slaughter them over the next few months and have them for dinner.
Well, I've done that myself. I've killed a few chickens and eaten them. So that's all at peakoilblues.com. Is that where we find it?
It's Peak Oil Blues, and actually the blog is peakoilblues.org/blog.
Okay, peakoilblues.org/blog for Kathy McMahon. She's a clinical psychologist who advises, writes, speaks about the energy threshold known as peak oil and climate change and severe economic stress. I've got a link to a great YouTube interview on Peak TV in my own blog at ecoshock.info. Kathy, I always feel better after talking with you, but I guess that's the point of talking with a psychologist. Thanks so much for helping us on Radio EcoShock.
It was my pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith. Next week on Radio EcoShock, we'll have more science, of course. I'll be talking with one of the big brains on biodiversity, Dr. Thomas Lovejoy. It seems even when we know the facts, humans don't act. We'll explore those mental blocks and the people who get past all that with the popular speaker, author, and advisor, Dr. Carolyn Baker. Find links for this show in my blog at ecoshock.info, and help me keep going if you can. Find out more at the website, too, ecoshock.org. There's lots to download there for free. As Kathy McMahon said, we have but one life to live. I'm Alex Smith, saying be kind to yourself, take it a day at a time, and find others to help you through the big change.